Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
And welcome to Mind Food Radio. Hello, Michael.
What a big week, hasn't it been?
It's another big week and another big program lined up.
It sure is. We've got a whole bunch of health professionals, doctors, psychologists.
Right up my alley.
How have you been feeling this week?
Oh, fairly good. And we've even got a sexologist.
I know. Very interesting indeed.
Very, very, very
kind of funny then the food director's talking about pulling pork.
Yes, and then it
can
goes
I
to
say
pork.
That, or is yeah, that just incorrect? That's not appropriate.
Get some more pork on your fork.
Anyway.
Hey, now what's our prize that we can win today on mindfood.com?
Well, we've got an interesting prize because, as, I don't know if you know, but in our new issue of the magazine, we've created a brand new section called Home, you know, with latest homes, kitchens,
yeah, like
bathrooms, the whole thing. So we thought to celebrate that, we're giving away one of five copies of A Girl's Guide to Decorating by Abigail Ahern, valued at $35.
So for more details and to go online to win that fabulous prize, go to mindfood.com.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Well, you know how I've always said I want to start my own vegetable garden?
Have you? Yes, I do.
Oh, yeah, come on. No, you know I'm always saying that.
How are you going to do it today?
Well, I have dreamed about it. I have read books. I've even said to the team, why don't we do it in the magazine?
Yeah.
Today, I have convinced Angus let's do a segment on how to start a vegetable garden.
Okay.
Welcome to the show, Angus.
Hi there, Michael. Good.
So, what's the first thing I need to do?
Keep it simple would be my advice.
Yes.
And the very first thing I would do is choose some really easy vegetables. And by that, I'm talking about leafy greens for your salads.
You know, I was at my local garden centre,
yes,
and they had these big sort of planks, you know, of wood, like railway sleepers. And they were saying, you know, if you put those in and then you... Is that the best way to start? Or, like, can you just dig the plot?
He's such a handyman.
Oh, I mean, I'm so DIY.
Watching him trying to describe this is actually quite funny.
But what is the best way? Is it best just to dig a plot into the ground, or should you line something and then do it that way and then put all the soil in?
Well, I guess it really depends on what sort of backyard you've got. And, even if you've got just a balcony or something like that, then I think you can... you're best off growing in a container, like a pot,
yep,
or a window box. But look, a raised bed, as you describe with sleepers, is a really good option if you've got a reasonable sized backyard.
Yeah.
Because you're just giving yourself the extra drainage that will allow you to grow the full range of,
yeah,
of vegetables.
Look, I dream of a pottage that I see in these beautiful English garden things. I don't think I'm quite there, or we have the space. But I do like the idea of a raised bed.
Is that better than planting it in the ground, like a raised bed?
Yes. Well, it's all about the drainage. And the raised bed allows you to just create really the perfect sort of soil. So if you've already got a really good soil that is well drained, and by that I mean if you dig a hole and fill it with water, it should drain away within about 15 minutes.
Oh, okay.
If it doesn't, then go for the raised bed idea. If you're going to do a raised bed, one thing to be careful of is treated pine, because it's got some fairly heavy-duty chemicals to stop it rotting away.
But it could leach into the plants.
Yeah, well, I just would rather not take the risk. Piling that hardwood timber, you know, like eucalypt, is much more sort of resistant to rotting away.
But you have to cut you have to dig the grass up first, don't you? Like, take the layer of grass off, or not? Can you just?
Well, you can. The thing is, if you create your raised bed, if you want to avoid doing all that work of digging up the grass, you can go for what's called a no-dig garden, which is a really good option in my view. What you essentially do with that is put down probably about 15 layers of newspaper over the top of the grass, and then that stops the light getting in, and then you put down alternate layers of best to use either loosened hay or pea straw.
Right.
Because they will rot away to make nice topsoil.
Well, that's a great step. I think we should really follow this as we go because, you know, I think this weekend I'm going to go.
I think this weekend I could be arriving at Michael's place with the chicken manure, and we'll get some photos in the magazine.
Yeah, we should. It's step by step. Let's do it.
Thank you, Angus, for coming on the show today.
All I can say is go forth and propagate.
Oh, now you're talking. Now you're talking my language.
Good on you.
See you, mate.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, there you go, Michael. Off to the garden we had this weekend.
But you know the crazy thing is I have been talking for years about doing this, but I now think, having heard how easy it is, I'm going to do it. You know, like I've done and lots of herbs and stuff, but I
there's something like, nice about I know, pulling decent. Your food out of the ground.
And
isn't
I think it's quite therapeutic getting out there at night after work and watering it. You know, like just,
yeah, especially you know, when you get home like midnight. Well, now on the program, Michael, we're heading into another area of, topic of discussion, eating disorders.
That's right. And on the line, we've got Chris Thornton, clinical psychologist. Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Chris.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, have you seen, you've been working in this area for nearly 20 years, have you seen an increase in eating disorders?
Look, the rates of anorexia have been pretty stable at about 0.5% to 1% of the female population, and they've probably been pretty stable for a long time, and similar with the rates of bulimia nervosa, which is the other common eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
They're about 1% or 2% of the population. Bulimia has increased a lot in the last 20 or 30 years, largely because of society's focus on the thin ideal and dieting. Anorexia is the third most common chronic illness of young women, with the other two, one being asthma and the other, you know, kind of paradoxically being obesity. And so we have, you know, high levels of eating concerns being two of the three most common issues facing adolescent girls.
For those people listening, Chris, what are some signs that we can be looking for?
With patients with anorexia nervosa, clearly the most obvious sign is weight loss, you know, significant amounts of weight loss. But very early on, you might see signs like an increased preoccupation with dieting, which I know, you know, affects most young women will diet, unfortunately.
Mm.
But people who go on to have anorexia or eating disorders will diet very harshly, they'll diet very rigidly, they'll sort of be on two or three diets all at the same time. And often they'll start a diet with a friend, and like most of us, you know, the average diet lasts for about two or three days. But somebody who has, you know, an eating disorder will diet, you know, in a very extreme kind of way.
Mm.
There'll be a lot of preoccupation with food, so there might be a lot of interest in cooking, there might be a lot of interest in, you know, cooking for other people. There might be an increase in activity, particularly exercise, particularly kind of solitary exercise.
Mm.
There are some early warning signs. I mean, the people that are perhaps, you know, potentially at risk for eating disorders, they're usually kids with, you know, they don't feel very good about themselves.
Mm.
So they might feel just kind of ineffective about the world, that there's not much they can do about it, not much they can control in the world.
Mm.
There's often an early sign for an eating disorder is high levels of anxiety in a child. And also one of the other conditions is being highly perfectionistic, highly obsessional. They're probably the setting conditions that are there for an eating disorder. The peak times of onset of anorexia are both at 13 and 14, which is usually when menarche is occurring, which is a big change both psychologically moving into adolescence from childhood, but also in terms of brain development, that's very important. Kids with eating disorders, their brain is probably wired in such a way that those changes that most of us would feel quite normal about are really quite overwhelming for them. In a way, they're not doing it because they want to do it. They're doing it because they have, you know, a brain-based psychiatric illness.
Mm, yeah. It's an amazing topic. I mean, it's sort of, it's obviously something that's on the increase and we need to be more aware of, particularly with people we work with or know personally, I suppose.
You know, one of the great days in Australia is Are You Okay Day, which, you know, the Beyond Blue and depression movement, you know, originated where, you know, you actually take some time to ask somebody at work, are you okay?
Mm.
And that's a really important resource, you know, for patients with, well, for anybody who's struggling with an eating problem as well.
Thanks, Chris. And also for more details in New Zealand and Australia in terms of for any more guidance, we'll run those details on mindfood.com. Clinical psychologist Chris Thornton will be one of our speakers at Mind and Its Potential later on the year that Mind Food is involved with. Chris, thanks a lot for today. It's been a very fascinating discussion.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
This is Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking.
Well, we've come to that time in the program, the My Story segment, and it's one that everybody loves to read about and hear about.
And so I'd like to welcome to today's show, Lucy Jones. Hi, Lucy.
Hi.
So you've got an extraordinary story that I know many listeners will get a lot from. You had a beautiful baby girl, Sienna. And at the age of 9 months, you took her to the doctor, and I'll let you pick up the story from there.
Yeah, so she was 9 months old, and she had a temperature, and like any first-time mother, I was slightly concerned, so I took her to the Sydney Children's Hospital. We'd only been in Australia about 7 weeks because we'd arrived from the UK, but a friend had said to me, if we ever had any concerns, to go to Sydney Children's Hospital. And the doctor there spent about an hour examining her, and they said to me and my partner, Oliver, that they thought her stomach was slightly bigger than it should be, and that they wanted to do more tests, etc. And then I was literally sitting in a hospital room when two doctors came in, and they said to me they had some very bad news for me, and that Sienna had a very large tumour in her abdomen, and that they couldn't tell me if it was benign or malignant, but just from the tone of their voice, I knew it was bad news, and it was very likely to be malignant. And the oncology team arrived shortly afterwards and told me they thought it was a children's cancer called neuroblastoma. And obviously we'd never heard of it, as a lot of people haven't. Mm. And they said it was, unfortunately, a difficult children's cancer, which existed in many different forms. And they'd have to do a biopsy and send it to the States for analysis to find out exactly what type of neuroblastoma it was. And we'd have to wait 2 weeks to find out. During that time, Sienna really deteriorated badly, and the tumour started growing very, very fast. It was already a large tumour. It was the size of like a grapefruit in her abdomen. And we had to start treatment before we got the results. And they believed it would be best to start with an intermediate risk type of treatment. So we started on that, and immediately the chemotherapy knocked the tumour back. And then we got the results back from the States, and unfortunately it was the very worst type of neuroblastoma. And we were told Sienna was high risk, and we'd have to change treatment to high risk treatment as well. The chemotherapy knocked back 5 out of the 6 tumours, but one of the tumours in the original site became chemo resistant. So it was very, very heartbreaking, but we couldn't stop it. And I was very heavily pregnant at the time with my second child. So we had a really traumatic 9 days in hospital where we were lying next to our daughter. And Jamie, my little boy, was in my tummy, alive and ready to come out to the world. And my little girl was literally dying next to me. So it was just one of those times where it was just so unbelievable what was happening in the worst possible kind. Mm. And when Jamie was born, he was born 5 days after Sienna passed. But I was actually having to do the funeral arrangements for my little girl, and Jamie came along to the funeral. And you know, that's very sadly the only time he ever met his sister. So having been through all this experience, I've spent a lot of time with my friends trying to raise awareness and funds for neuroblastoma.
For anyone listening to this, you can go to ccia.org.au to make a donation. Simply fill out and return you know, a form in there, and you can donate. And Lucy, I'd like to thank you very much for telling us your story. I know a lot of our listeners at Mindfood Radio, it would have touched them. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you for listening, and thank you for giving me time on your radio. I much appreciate it.
Into the kitchen we head, Michael.
I know, and I've been wanting to talk to the chef because it's at that very popular new restaurant in Melbourne, Henry and the Fox.
Love.
Welcome
the
to the show, Michael.
Thank
Fox.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've had a pretty good career. You've worked with Shannon Bennett in Melbourne and had some extraordinary international experience in England. Tell us about the restaurant there.
So I was working for Raymond Blanc at Le Manoir Quatre-Saisons, which is a 2-star Michelin French boutique hotel in the countryside of Oxfordshire. Yeah, absolutely fantastic experience. 2 years hard graft.
It was well worth it, was it? Because so many chefs, I guess, dream of those sort of roles. But in reality, is it tough?
It is tough. It's massive hours, massive weeks. You know, sleep deprived. But what gets you up in the morning is just that constant urge to keep learning and to keep pushing yourself, I guess.
That's right. And I guess an experience you'll never forget.
Hey, for some of our listeners, what does it mean to have a hat? What's that mean?
I guess what it means is that you're setting a standard in any food scene in any city, wherever you are, whether it be a Michelin hat, a Michelin star, or a hat here in Melbourne. I think it's just being able to constantly strive, complete package, basically. Mm. Yeah.
Now, you're one of the lineup of chefs at the exclusive six-course culinary event for Food for Thought for the Stroke Foundation in Melbourne.
Yeah.
On May 24th. Can you lead us into a secret, and what are you going to be cooking?
I'm going to be doing one of my favourite dishes we have on the menu here. It's a rabbit terrine. So basically, I'm taking what is essentially a classical dish and bringing it to 2012, basically. So we'll be doing slow cooking some rabbit and breaking it down and mixing it with sort of classic flavours, Dijon mustard and tarragon and capers, and then rolling that in some hamon, so a nice disc of the terrine, and serving it with sort of all elements rhubarb. So we'll have rhubarb compote, rhubarb jelly, rhubarb salad, and then just some house-made brioche.
Yum.
So very simple dish, but I think it eye appeal, looks great, tastes great, very comforting, but also quite interesting with the rhubarb as well. So, I think I'm placed at about a fourth course in, so mine will be sort of the one just before the main course.
I guess as with the winter coming and it's getting cooler and we're sort of all turning to comfort food.
Yeah, definitely.
Tell us some of your favourite comfort food.
Definitely the beef cheek. I think it's become up and coming cut, I guess. And it's so beautiful. We cook ours for 12 hours here in a nice sort of rich glaze. Also using lamb neck at the moment, which is it just opens up a whole new window winter with the slower cooked meats and your secondary cuts, I guess. So you're saving money on buying some secondary cuts and really putting in the effort to reap the rewards, I guess.
It's amazing how, every few years a new cut, a meat cut sort of comes along, isn't it? And often, growing up, you'd never think you'd be, talking to a lamb neck and things like that. It's amazing.
Yeah, so. I think what started that off was the lamb shank that,
you could
pick up from your butcher and you wouldn't pay a cent for it. But these days, it's so expensive. And, there are no cheap cuts of meat anymore. It's just cheaper.
Now, helping support the National Stroke Foundation, have you yourself had anyone suffer a stroke close to you or in your family?
So this is my second year with Stroke Foundation. Originally got involved because I lost one of my grandmas and grandpas, and also my auntie as well. So something very close to me, and I guess it's not until you start reading some of the facts involved with stroke, it just completely opens up your eyes, and such a big killer.
Well, you're doing a great thing in supporting the foundation, and the dinner in Melbourne is on May 24th, and for more details, go to mindfood.com. Thank you, Michael. It's been great talking with you and having you on today's show.
Thanks very much. It's good to talk to you guys.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
I love segments like this. For people that have hypochondria like me, as you would say, Michael, no, I'm only joking. We're talking about brain health. It's very important in today's world.
It is. And as you know, it's the most vital organ.
I didn't know that, but I now do know that. I thought your heart was. We've got a psychologist, brain health and thinking, lovely Dr. Lee Hodder's joining us. How are you, Doctor?
I'm well, thank you.
Now, you've worked up a series of workshops, haven't you, in and around brain health?
Yes, I have, and also thinking styles, because we need to get out of the rut of how we normally think.
And it's interesting, some of the guests we've had on Mind Food Radio, they've talked about, what happens in your 20s and your 30s and 40s, but they've all said, as we get older, the mind is the most important thing that we should really focus on in terms of, general intelligence and development. For Mind Food, that's what we're all about in terms of smart thinking. Tell us a little bit about the brain health that you specialise in.
What I've discovered is a very scary statistic, is that by 2050, there's going to be a 254% increase in degenerative brain diseases in Australia. And it's primarily because we have an ageing population and also because of our current lifestyle. So given that the brain is the most vital organ in the body and without it we basically will fall to the ground and not be doing too much, I decided to come up with a workshop to improve people's brain health.
We're seeing a lot more of anxiety and depression and stuff like that coming through these days. Is that a sort of prerequisite to what the future is going to be like?
Yes, they say that depression will certainly be on the increase over the next few years, as will things such as Alzheimer's and senile dementia.
You're kind of at the other end of that, though, aren't you? You're sort of trying to help people before perhaps they slip into that depression or have those
Absolutely. No, my workshops are aimed to reduce the likelihood of those sorts of brain diseases occurring.
Tell me about, in terms of our brain, what are some things that we can do to make our brain more healthy?
Oh, there's lots of things. We can eat all the foods that we're supposed to eat for a healthy body. The brain loves potassium, which you find in bananas. It needs the omega-3 fatty acids, which, of course, fish is traditionally called brain food. It also needs carbohydrates. So to all those people who are on the low-carbohydrate, high-protein diet, I wonder why they're thinking fuzzy, that would be why. It needs oxygen, plenty of it. So for all those people who smoke, they need to stop. We need a lot of water. The brain's very fluid, and it's a terrible term, but it slops around in the brain pan, and if we lose as much as, or as little, sorry, as 1% of our body fluid, our brains actually start shrinking, and that's why we get fuzzy thinking and headaches.
There are three little things we can do. How important is exercise? We talk to a lot of doctors here and they say exercise is a key, another area for your brain.
Very much so. Physical exercise, which of course is going to increase your oxygen to your brain, and also mental exercise in the form of doing crosswords or Sudoku or learning a new language or just doing something different.
And sleep is so important, isn't it?
Oh, very much so.
From your point of view, Dr. Lee, what are some sleep techniques that we can be really doing to help our brain just stop and switch off?
Okay. We need to understand that sleep comes in 90-minute waves. So if you miss one, get up and do something really, really boring. And then when you feel that next sleep wave coming on, if you're an insomniac, try and catch that one in. We need to understand that watching TV and playing with your computer till late at night, all that does is signal the brain that it's time to be awake.
Dr. Lee Hodder, thank you very much for your insights in terms of brain and its potential, and thanks for being on today's show.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
Now time on Mind Food Radio to talk about a topic about affection. Dr. Michelle Garnett joins us, and this is a very interesting interview, how we can help assist kids with Asperger's syndrome to understand and express affection.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Michelle. How are you?
Hello, well, happy to be here. Thank you.
I love the name of your project. The Affection Project. It doesn't get much better than that, does it?
No, I love the name of it as well. And it is apt because the whole project, what we do with the kids, is all about expressing affection, whether that be with our family members or our friends. There's a lot to learn within that topic.
There sure is. Now, the clinic was actually born through, I guess, you know, your passion for understanding autism.
Yes.
And a strong desire, I guess, to be part of a positive change for people who, you know, perhaps have that within their families.
How difficult
has that been in terms of working with families and letting them understand, I guess, that world of autism?
Unfortunately, for families who have a child with Asperger's syndrome, there's been little help around. There's been little understanding, unfortunately. And there's been often a long road toward appropriate and accurate diagnosis and then the proper interventions and assistance that follows.
Years ago, people wouldn't have been diagnosed with these types of things. Is it because there's more diagnosis that, you know, we're seeing a lot more of this? Because was it around a long time before?
Absolutely. This is a part of the brain that's fascinating. We have brains that are very social brains. They do social really well. The small talk, they're getting along with each other. And then we have brains that are much better. They're wired for information and facts. And our Aspies have always been here, but they've been discovering things and contributing to facts and knowledge. But certainly it's always been part of Brain Difference. We're now beginning to understand Brain Difference at much finer levels of analysis. And one of those is the social brain and how important it is.
Now, also part of it in terms of that understanding, I guess, is the, you know, how to express affection. And in that, I guess, the power of a hug, isn't it? And how healing or harming that is.
Yeah, yeah. And it's difficult, I think, for us to perceive of a hug as being harmful. And yet, we know that for many who are on the autism spectrum, a hug, it can be an overwhelming tidal wave of sensation which can send them further into experiencing uncomfortable emotions like anxiety, stress, and sometimes anger. So at a neurotypical, someone who doesn't have autism will think that a hug is bound to help. You know, you always feel better after a hug. It fixes the feeling. But if we apply that logic or that inner knowing from our social brain to someone on the autism spectrum, we could actually be, as I say, chugging them straight through into a more powerful, extreme negative emotion, and that's not helpful.
Do adults get diagnosed later in life?
Yes, certainly. Many adults that we see at Minds and Hearts are coming to the diagnosis later, and that's just because of what you were talking about before. We didn't have the knowledge earlier about Asperger's syndrome to diagnose them when they were younger. But with more knowledge now, there's a literature base, there's more movies, TV shows coming out with characters with Asperger's syndrome in them, and people are relating to it and realizing, wow, that sounds like me. I need to find out. And often they describe then that they have the missing piece to the puzzle. They understand themselves better. It's often a pathway to a greater self-acceptance and a sense of well-being about who they are.
Dr. Michelle Garnett, it's great to have you on the show. As I said right at the start, a perfect name, The Affection Project. I just love it. I think what you're doing is brilliant.
Thank you.
And, for more details, go to mindfood.com.
Thank you. That was lovely to talk to you. Great to talk about this topic.
Yeah. Good on you. You're doing great work.
Thank you.
Well, on Mind Food Radio, we always get some really interesting interviews, and we've had lots of therapists on, but never one with this title, Michael.
Exactly. Nikki Goldstein is a sexologist, and I guess the work she did in mediation at Relationships Australia for couples going through divorce was a bit of a tipping point for her, and she realised then and there that this was, I guess, the work that she wanted to focus on. Hi, Nikki. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, during that time, that must have been, I guess at times, a little soul-destroying.
Well, I would probably say little is an understatement.
Oh,
like,
really?
You are locked into an office with two people who cannot stand to be in the same room of each other and are, you know, yelling and screaming and also blaming you for a lot of their, you know, problems and why aren't I fixing things. And, you know, after a while, it's a very rewarding job at times, but you lose your faith in humanity and you start to lose your faith in marriage and relationships. So it does take a toll. You know, I mean, I did deal with a lot of cases that, you know, dealt with infidelity and things like that, but I found that, you know, before we even addressed the sex life, there were bigger problems to deal with, and this was the fact that, you know, they could not be in the same room with each other. They couldn't stand the sight of each other. Sex is something always interesting, and it did come up. It was funny. A few cases, you know, you don't know how to deal with it at first when people decide to talk to you about the intimate details of their sex life, but after a while, I think you get used to it, and it just becomes another piece to the puzzle in a relationship. You don't giggle and say, oh, that's really awkward. You know, you've got your finances and you've got your children, and hey, we might also be addressing something sexually as well, and that's okay.
You went on and got a doctorate from the Institute of Advanced Study of Human Sexuality in San Francisco, and in fact, you're the first Australian to ever receive that accolade. What has that done for you in terms of the practice?
I changed courses dramatically. I left private practice and I now focus on education, because I went over there and so much of what was taught to me, you know, it was like a light bulb moment. You sit there and go, why aren't we teaching this to people, to young children, to couples, you know, the reason that these relationships are failing is because no one's given them the information. No one has told them how to effectively communicate, or no one's explained that we don't have to fit into molds and we can make our relationships on our own. So my focus shifted, and I thought, well, instead of sitting in an office and only dealing with one or two people at a time, I'm going to go down the path of education and be able to speak to a wide audience of people and give them those tools so maybe they might be a couple that doesn't end up in therapy.
And tell me, in terms of communication, you know, for those listeners that are listening, what are a couple of tips that they can gain from today?
Active listening, you know, not crossing your arms when you're talking to someone, nodding your head, making sure that they know that you've been heard, clarifying information. You know, people communicate a lot and then you get the misinterpretation. Sometimes you need to turn around to your partner and say, so, have I heard correctly, is it this that you are angry about, or is it this particular thing you would like me to do? Picking your moments, you know, don't go and have that awkward conversation before you're going to bed in the bedroom.
Well, it's been a very interesting interview. Nikki Goldstein, sexologist, thank you very much for joining us on the radio show.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm not a sexologist, but for some people today, they're probably sitting there, Michael, going, I don't know whether I can put this into practice, but my suggestion is get a suggestion box.
Well, who knows?
That's why we have email. That's my suggestion box. I always say to people, if you have a question, I don't give out my phone number, but I do say to them, if you have a question, you can always email me and I can give you a few little pointers.
Thanks, Nikki. That's wonderful. And of course, for more details, jump on to mindfood.com.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Now time to talk food.
One of my favourite subjects, I've got to say. Now, have you noticed when you dine now in restaurants how much pork there is on menus?
Can't believe it. It's everywhere.
Exactly. Sweets are. It doesn't really matter what sort of cuisine.
Is there an oversupply of pork?
I don't know. But even globally, I notice, you know, as I've travelled around the place, pork has become a really mainstay on menus.
Michelle can tell us why.
She can.
After welcome the snow egg she had a few weeks ago.
I'd like to welcome to Mind Food Radio today our food director, Michelle. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Very well.
Do you think that, though? Like, there just seems to be this abundance of pork on menus these days.
Well, I have to say, it's the first thing I look for in the main section. I love pork. It's one of my absolute all-time favourites. I grew up in a rural place, and it was a bit of a treat to have a roast pork of an evening, so I love it.
Mm. Was it kind of like your Sunday roast?
It was our Sunday roast. We had a name for the pig, Shorty, so sometimes I had to check, Mum, is this Shorty? And she would say yes or no, so depending on the answer is whether I ate it or not.
That'd be enough to put me off, I think. Poor old Shorty. And what was it?
He tasted good.
But I noticed in the latest issue, and one of my favourite sections, Dinner Tonight, Lunch Tomorrow.
Yes, that's a section we've got in every issue. It's sort of what we call it, cook once, eat twice. And in this issue that's on sale now, we've got pulled pork. And we've given you the recipe to how to make it. It's absolutely beautiful and very, very easy.
So what is pulled pork, though? What does that mean?
Pulled pork is pork. We've cooked it give it a rub of cumin and paprika and chilli with black pepper, and then we slowly cook it in a casserole dish with some Worcester and mustard, and then we leave it with a sealed lid in the oven for, oh gosh, I think 5 to 6 hours, and it just slowly breaks down. You stir it and turn it occasionally.
Right.
And then you let it sit for just a little bit longer. There's still plenty of juice in the bottom of the dish, and then you just pull the meat away and let it soak up all those juices. It's absolutely beautiful. It's tender and an absolute treat.
So, Michelle, I've actually tried this recipe. It's absolutely beautiful, and you're right, the meat is really succulent. Is that hard to get in terms of that cooking process?
No, it's just a matter. Just go to your butcher and ask him for pork shoulder, and get it, leave the bone in and the skin on, and I think just with the way we've prepared it for you, with the way we've got the instructions, it will turn out beautifully.
Is there crackling on this one?
No, there's no crackling.
Oh, I can't see it.
No,
Michael's got the magazine.
And also, it's actually not dry. That was the thing that surprised me.
Oh, wow.
It's very moist. Very tasty. Mm.
So in terms of it, I noticed in the magazine you can make a beautiful burger. What else can you do with it?
Well, we've got one option is to make it with a with into a burger with a spicy slaw with your lovely cabbage, which is in season at the moment, and carrots, so that's beautiful. Or you can turn it into a, which is very fashionable at the moment, if you're talking about restaurants, tortillas with barbecue corn. So you just slice some nice avocado, some red onions, some coriander, and that makes another beautiful meal. You can take that to lunch the next day and have it and make everyone at the office very jealous.
That sounds delicious.
As they say, get some pork on your fork.
Oh, it sounds very good.
It does, doesn't it? I look forward to that.
Very good.
It does look delicious. Michael is now ripping the page out. He's that hungry.
And licking it. Michelle, thank you very much. We always enjoy talking with you.
Okay. Radio.
Thanks, Michelle. Bye.
Bye.
Well, we're off to the kitchen. Michelle is rushing out there to cook something for us.
What are you going to have for dinner tonight?
I actually think I would love to have that wonderful pork little burger roll type thing that's in the magazine, but it's going to take 7 hours to prepare.
But apparently you get a lot of meals from it, so it could do you for a whole week.
Yeah, well, that's right. So what are you doing?
I'm off to the garden. What do you think?
Oh,
I'm scared if I don't report back next week with my first stage in my veggie garden.
He's going to mock up a photo or something, folks, I can tell you.
Go and photograph the neighbour's garden.
We're going to put you on mindfood.com with it, I reckon. So next week on the program, more fun and, of course, more prizes. So if you'd like to find out more details on today's program, jump on to
mindfood.com.
And that's it for another week. Thank you for joining us on the radio show, Mind Food Radio.
Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia. Produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.